Hello, this is Philip Cargom. Welcome to this interview made in July 2018, in which I interview the sex and relationship therapist Juliette Grayson. And in the interview, I ask her about her work, and we delve into some of the key ideas in her book, Landscapes of the Heart. I'm here with a friend, Juliette Grayson, in her lovely home in Wales, in Monmouthshire, just the other side of the bridge as you come over from England. And on a lovely kind of blustery day, we've had a couple of months almost, it feels like, of baking hot weather, and it's just broken, you know, so the air is fresh and it feels good, doesn't it? So, So Juliette, and I've just finished reading your book, and I enjoyed it tremendously, and I learnt a lot from it. And it's a book called Landscapes of the Heart. And I learnt a lot, not only as a human being, as it were, as somebody in a relationship, and who obviously, as we all do, have relationships with people through our lives, but also as a psychotherapist. And so I'm taking this opportunity of being with you now to talk to you about the book. And first of all, maybe you can share with our listeners what you do. What is your job?
Well, I'm a sex and relationship therapist. That's primarily what I do. So I work with couples, mostly couples, but sometimes individuals, helping them have a... I think everybody deserves a good enough relationship. So I'm helping them have a good enough relationship and a good enough sex life.
And when you're saying good enough, you're using it in the sense that Winnicott used it, that if we tell ourselves that we want the best, we're probably going to spend a lifetime of being disappointed.
Absolutely.
And he came up with this concept of the good enough mother.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But on the other hand, you know, there are people who put up with really not good enough, and they settle for this is the best I'm going to get. And actually, I think we all deserve something, you know, a decent relationship, a decent sex life. So that's one of the things I do. I also run courses for therapists to teach them how to work with couples and sexual problems. And I have set up a charity which is called STOPSO, which is the Specialist Treatment Organisation for Perpetrators and Survivors of Sexual Offences.
Right.
So that's working with people who feel at risk of committing a sexual offence, or who is someone who was sexually abused at some point in their lives. And we've set up a network of therapists across the whole of the UK who can work with people. Primarily, our aim is to prevent the first sexual offence and to stop people being sexually abused, children, adults.
That's fantastic, because so much of people's attention is focused on after the event. And what you're doing is you're saying to people, look, if you've had those thoughts or feelings before you do anything, give us a call
and
come and get help. So you're going right to the heart of the problem. So many problems in the world seem to deal with them. I mean, God, look at, you know, climate change and just virtually every problem. You know, we deal with the consequences rather than going right back to the beginning. And
you know, in the UK, obviously, I mean, in whatever country you are, no one wants child abuse to happen. And yet we now know because of neuroscience that actually people are born with a sexual attraction to children. It forms in the fourth and fifth month of pregnancy.
Really?
So there are some people who are born with that sexual attraction. There's nothing they can do about that. Just as I was born heterosexual, some people are born homosexual, some people are born with an attraction to children. And the reason why they know that's happened is because they have a whole load of traits that happen in the fourth and fifth month of pregnancy. So they're three times more likely to be left-handed, 2 centimetres shorter than the general population, 10 IQ points lower than the general population, more likely to have webbed fingers and webbed toes. And all of these cluster of things happen in the fourth or fifth month of pregnancy.
So you're saying the genetic influence is really strong.
Well, it might be genetic, or it might be that there's a neurochemical something that happens through stress or through toxicity that happens that influences the fetus.
Mm.
But if you're born that way, if you're born with an attraction to children,
mm.
you're not responsible for your sexual orientation,
mm.
but you are responsible for your sexual behaviour.
That's a huge distinction to make, isn't it? You're not yeah. responsible for your orientation, but you're responsible for your behaviour. Yeah.
So our job at StopSo is to help people who are aware that they have an unusual or unsociable sexual preference.
Mm.
And that might include voyeurism and flashing and all kinds of things. Mm. And help them never to act on that. And so to live pro-social lives rather than anti-social lives.
That's a fantastic aim. And you were telling me yesterday about the statistics for the amount of abuse that's occurring. Say that again.
Oh, it's just unbelievable. So there were 64,667 police recorded incidents of child abuse in 1 year.
1 year.
The Children's Commissioner says 1 in 8 people, 1 in 8 children actually report their sexual abuse.
Hmm.
So if you multiply that figure, 64,667, by 8.
Yeah.
Divide that by 365,
hmm.
it means that every day there are 1,417 new cases of sexual abuse against a child in the UK,
hmm.
365 days a year, 1,417, and there are only 1,440 minutes in a day, so hmm. almost 1 a minute.
Almost 1 a minute, and that's almost inevitably occurring in other places like the United States as
it's, well. It's, the stats are yes.
fairly uniform yeah. across the world.
Yeah.
That is horrendous. And you told me how you had a promotion for your charity where you planted pinwheels in the ground alongside the Thames. Was it opposite
right.
the Houses of Parliament?
That's right.
1,417 for it on the grass like that, and to draw attention to it. And hardly any newspaper or magazine would even carry that piece of news of that, you know, because visually it's an extraordinary, that photograph of all these pinwheels is extraordinary, and they wouldn't even carry it.
Yeah, it's just, I find it deeply shocking. And our intention is to do that again in a few years' time and, you know, hopefully to be planting less pinwheels. But at the yeah. moment, the statistics are going up. And, mm. You know, stop. So we've had over 2,000 people who've come to us asking for help so far.
Mm.
So people are out there who know that they have a problem mm. and want help not to act on it. Mm. The other statistic that I find shocking is that 51, we had an online questionnaire and it mm. says, at what age did you first know you had a problem with your sexual thinking or behaviour?
Mm.
51% know by the time they're 16 years old.
Yeah.
And 72% know by the time they're 25, but only 3% of the people coming to StopSo yeah. are under 25.
Yeah.
So we really need to target young adults and let them know that there's help out there, and that they should come forward and you know, meet with a therapist and get some one-to-one, face-to-face therapy local to them within a few days of them asking for help. And we need to, you know, that's now available, and we need to let the public know that they can do that.
It's available because you've got a network of therapists who you have trained
yes.
to do this work around the UK. We're talking about just the UK
just
at the moment.
UK
just
at
the
moment.
UK. And does it apply to Scotland? And is it just England? Is it, or is it all
England,
of you?
England, Ireland, Wales, and we've the whole of the UK.
The whole of the UK. Great, great.
Scotland.
And Scotland as well. Fantastic. And if they ring the StopSo number, they can get help. And
the website is www.stopso.org.uk.
Great, thank you. And is there any evidence to show that your therapy helps?
We have lots of anecdotal evidence to show that yeah. it helps. And the research which is done on group therapy largely
hmm.
shows that there's a 26.3% reduction in reincarceration.
Right.
In other words, going back to prison.
Yeah.
For people who've been treated as opposed to those that haven't been treated. My fantasy is that one-to-one therapy is going to be more successful because it's tailor-made to what that individual actually needs.
Yeah.
And we are in the middle of an evaluation project at the moment. But the heartbreaking thing is that not everybody can afford to pay for their therapy.
Yeah.
So there are 20% of the people who come to us who are either... So, for instance, the other week I had someone age 14 email me saying, I've been a paedophile all my life.
Aye, aye, aye.
And I thought, what do you mean all your life? You're 14 years old. So I said, you know, who are you attracted to? And this person said, I'm attracted to 2-year-olds to 8-year-olds.
Mm.
And, you know, and I was the first person that they'd reached out to. And but obviously they're not going to be able to pay for their therapy. So at the moment, we're trying to find people who will offer help when people need it and can't pay. But what we need to do is get some funding for that at some point.
You need funding for that. Government or, of course, angels who appear,
exactly.
Good-hearted people who are willing to see this as a really worthy cause. Because if that 14-year-old person can be helped, who knows what suffering can be avoided.
Both for it? Them, because yeah. It's a devastating thing to recognise that you have this attraction. But also all the victims who won't be created
Absolutely.
If they get the help.
Now, from a lay point of view, you might think that is it mainly male? I don't know. In my mind, I associate this problem mainly with men.
It is predominantly male, but I think there's probably more of an issue with females than we recognise.
Yeah.
The statistics generally show 10% females.
Hmm.
I suspect it's a bit more than that.
Yeah.
But... that's what the stats say, it's 90% men.
Okay. And is the therapy mainly, is it a sort of protocol that you've developed yourself, a way of one-to-one working that you've developed yourself to treat them, or are you basing it on...
What we do is we take therapists who are already trained and experienced and working in their own methodology.
Yeah.
Then we teach them about... Firstly, the law and ethics. Mm. So at what point would you report someone and, you know, when not to report? Mm. So it's what we're asking therapists to do is to have a proportionate response to risk because in the past we've had people who've come who reached out for help when they had troublesome thoughts, didn't have access to children, didn't have children of their own. I would say having... assess them and talk to them that they weren't
going to
a
act.
Living risk of, yeah. you know, of being committing a contact offence against a child. And they weren't looking at child abuse images either. So at that point, if it was me, I would treat them without reporting them. But a lot of therapists are terrified of this field and either don't want to do it or judge and criticise and shame the client. Or report them when actually they don't need to be reported. So one of the things our training does is it teaches people or it gets them to think about where their line is for themselves about reporting. Because, of course, if someone is committing a contact offence, then you would report that. Or in this country.
Mm.
What's really interesting is in Germany, the confidentiality agreement is different. And so it's actually illegal for a therapist to report someone. Even if they say, I'm going to go and have sex with a 2-year-old in half an hour, it's illegal for the therapist to report them.
Gosh.
What that means is it makes it very safe for people to come forward and ask for help. And, you know, it goes against what you think because the public's response is report them, lock them up, make
them
safe.
Throw away the key. Yeah.
But actually, what we need to do is think about the fact that if you make it safe enough for people to come forward to help, they're more likely to come forward for help. And then if they get help and it's effective, then they're not
they're
going
less
to act
likely
out.
To commit, yeah.
If you report everybody and the people who need help know they're likely to get reported, they're not going to come forward and ask for help. And so actually what happens is they go underground and they're more dangerous.
Yeah.
So the Germans have this very enlightened view to it all. And they have this, it's illegal for the therapist to report. But over here, that's not the situation. So our advice is, if it's a contact offence, obviously you report. If it's troublesome thoughts, then you need to do a risk assessment and decide as a therapist you know, what you, how to handle that. So one of the aspects of the training is to help people think that through, get very clear about the law around sexual offending, what's legal, what's not legal. A lot of people don't realise that, for instance, looking at images of someone who is 17, who is being sexual, is illegal. You're allowed to have sex at 16, but you're having sex at 17 is legal. But looking at someone who's naked, who is 17, is illegal.
But if they're 18, it's not illegal?
If they're over 18, it's not illegal.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay.
So helping people to get really clear about the nuances of the law is also important. And then helping people to realise things like they call them the criminogenic factors. In other words, what's likely to go along with someone acting in this way, and you know, that's problems with sociability, being very good at making friends often but not always, not very good at handling stress. So there are a whole load of symptoms that, or aspects that make someone a high risk or a low risk, and we teach those on the training course.
Are there correlations with forms of mental illness? I don't know, schizophrenia, autism. Autism has been reclassified as not being a mental illness, but that's a whole area of discussion for another day. But are there correlations with?
There's this thing that the classic. Person who is a paedophile, and the clinical definition of a paedophile is that it's your primary or exclusive sexual attraction to prepubescent children, other words 11 and under. So one of the things that people get muddled up about is there are a lot of people who are child molesters who are not paedophiles, so their primary attraction is to adults, but they may commit a contact offence against a child. And there are a lot of people who are attracted to children who never, ever, ever act on that and never look at child abuse images and never commit a contact offence. But coming back to your question, which is about does it go with... So the research shows that they're likely to be 10 IQ points lower than the general population. There is a group of autistic people who commit sexual offences. Because they're not good at reading the signals for yes and no.
Okay.
So that's one thing. But I'm not aware of anything like schizophrenics are more likely to be. I'm not aware of anything like that.
Okay. Okay. Are you involved in education for the police? Because you know a huge amount about this subject. Do you get involved in sort of trainings for the police? Or?
No, our patron is Simon Bailey, who's the Chief Constable for Norfolk and Police. And he is the National Police Chief's lead for child abuse.
Right,
and
right.
has recently become our patron.
So you've got good contacts with the police in that
and
sense.
And we various police forces ask us to work with their offenders. So they may hand out our business card to someone who maybe they've arrested but they don't have enough evidence to charge, or maybe they charge them and they'll put them in touch with us. So that would be
just that, I can imagine, you know, the amount of people they arrest, but they can't, haven't got enough evidence to charge. But to put them your way, as it were, would be hugely helpful. Well, thank you. That's given a really good orientation on one side of your work.
Yes, and then another side of my work is that I go up and down the country and I deliver personal development groups. So I have various ongoing groups using a particular methodology, which I talk about in the book, which is called the Pesso-Boyden system of psychomotor. And that's a way of working with an individual in the context of a group. And what we do is we use... I'm completely passionate about the methods. I love it. Because what it does is it takes the soul and the ego, and it works with both sides of a person. So the theory is that the soul is born knowing what it needs. So a baby gets hungry and it cries and it should get fed, and that brings satisfaction. But sometimes, because our parents are depressed or alcoholic or not available or didn't have good childhoods themselves, they're not able to meet all of our basic needs.
Or they've read a book about scheduled feeding from the 1950s and they don't feed the baby.
Bless Dr. Spock.
Dr. Spock, yes, exactly.
So So what the Peter Boyden does is it's using members of the group who role play ideal figures, maybe an ideal mother and an ideal father. We can give the person what it is that they should have had in the first place. So it's a very reparative, healing situation. And what Al Pesso, the founder of the method, or co-founder of the method with his wife Diane Boyden, said is that healing has to happen at the right age with the right kinship relationship. So it's interesting because it comes up in the book. What often happens is that if I didn't get enough validation as a child, then I go around the world looking for validation. I want my boss to validate me, and I want my, you know, I meet a boyfriend who validates me, that's right. And then I think, well, you'll do, so I marry them. And they keep validating me, but it's like it goes into a bottomless pit. And it never, ever fills me up. So I say, you're never giving me enough validation. And you say, well, I'm fed up with this because I can't do enough, so I'll stop. And what Al Pesso would say is that your partner can never fill that hole, because the hole should have been filled by parents.
Yeah.
So in the method, what we do is we use people representing ideal parents who can symbolically give you what you needed. So you get the validation that you needed, and it lands in a different kind of a way. So it goes in, and it seems, it's fascinating. It seems as if it fills that hole up that people have had for decades.
Well, I'm really glad you've explained this, because your book, you start off, you move towards that, and then about halfway through you introduce the Peter Boyden technique, and somebody reading it might well think, well, how can it possibly make a difference given the damage, if you like, or the wounding that's occurred, or the lack that's occurred in childhood? How can acting out an ideal father, an ideal mother, and so on, and in a kind of method perhaps reminiscent on first hearing, to psychodrama, to gestalt, to even constellation theory, how can that possibly work? But my experience of reading it is, as I started to read and you gave examples and you gave the theory, I started to see how, yes, indeed, it could work. And it reminded me of the training I had in sophrology, where you're working with pathways in the nervous system, how this extraordinary fact, really, which was... you know, which is that the nervous system can't distinguish between fantasy and reality.
Exactly.
And so you have in PTSD and trauma, you have this thing of when you're going through an episode, your body doesn't know that the bombs aren't dropping.
Absolutely.
Around you. And that's awful, of course. But the positive side of it is you can use this to literally create new physical pathways in your nervous system. You know, so sophrology is all about creating new pathways and all the rest of it. And this is what I understand is happening with Peter Boyden, is you're acting out with, you know, and listeners will be able to read in the book where you go into detail about it. But essentially what's happening is you're going through an experience where you're repairing... Or is that how you'd put it? You're creating experiences which are somehow getting bedded down in the nervous system in some way. Or you know, if you wanted to get esoteric, I suppose you could say the sort of soul memory, or something's happening that is acting in a healing way.
Yeah, and the person is having a literal experience now. So, for example, the one that's popped into my head was a guy who's mother was very distracted when he was born and had a bit of postnatal depression. And he, in a structure as a 55-year-old, 6'4" man, ended up with an ideal mother. And he was laying on a sofa and she was holding him in her arms, and they eye gazed. So he wasn't literally breastfeeding off her, but it was the sort of stuff that would have gone on during breastfeeding. And I could watch him drinking in the love from her gaze.
Yeah.
And when you're in a role in this method as an ideal mother, which you take on the role and then you let the role go at the end of the session, it's as if an archetype comes through people. And so she was Earth Mother. And the look that she was giving him was just blissful.
And it was feeding his soul. And it was feeding that sort of wounded child.
Absolutely.
Who hadn't got that.
And yeah. I was saying to him towards, you know, for maybe 10 minutes, we were all in silence, in awe of what was happening. And she was saying the words that he most wanted to hear. You know, I would always be there for you. I would always love you. And I'm here now. And if I'd been your ideal mother when you were first born, I would have held you with this kind of love. And you would have seen the love in my eyes. And I would have gazed adoringly at you, and so on and so forth. And I saw him entering into a state of bliss and taking it in. And then I, as the therapist, invite him to put the feeling that he's having now as a 55-year-old adult back in time into his baby self, so that he links this feeling with an image of himself as a child. Yeah. And our brains are so extraordinarily creative and able to put these. So he had a real experience which he now has put back in his timeline. So we've given him a fantasy experience or a synthetic experience or another experience that sits beside his real experience, which was of lack and of deficit. But now he has this experience of fullness and richness. And it
reminds me of something I was watching the other day by a psychologist who's done a lot of work on behavioral economics, actually. And it's called The Riddle. It's a TED talk called The Riddle of the Remembered Self versus the Experiencing Self. And he talks about this extraordinary way in which we've got two selves in a way. There's the self that is experiencing in the moment, this sort of, you know, 3-second window that's constantly sort of moving, as it were. And then there's the self who is the remembered self. And if you think it's as simple as the two being, you know, one just feeding the other, it's not. He gives a fascinating example. He gives the results of the experience of a colonoscopy taken over a 20-minute period. And every 60 seconds, they're asking a patient in an experience that apparently is better now, but when they did this, it was extremely uncomfortable. Every 60 seconds, the patient would have to rate the level of pain they were experiencing on a scale of 1 to 10. So they'd go, 10, 9, 8, 7, you know, etc. And then you see it on a graph. So they said, patient A. And one patient has the experience, and it finishes. It's all pretty intense and awful. And it finishes on a high, you know, very painful experience. And it stops at 10, like that. The other patient has a 20-minute colonoscopy, and they have exactly the same sort of experience for the first 10 minutes. The second 10 minutes is pretty uncomfortable as well, but it slowly tapers down. So who's had more pain? Well, obviously the second patient, because he's gone on for 20 minutes. Talk to the remembering self half an hour later and a year later and get them to rate how much pain they experience. And the person who had the 20-minute experience believes that they had significantly less pain than the first one.
Yeah.
Because of the latency of memory and so on, like that. Yeah. You see. Yeah. Do you see what I mean? So that's absolutely, so it shows the plasticity of the remembered self.
Yes.
And what I hear you doing with this kind of work is in a sense helping, playing with, working with the remembered self. So even though the experience is artificial, in quotation marks, actually,
it is artificial on one level, but actually this guy was having a real experience.
In the
here and now, he was really enjoying being given permission to eye gaze with this woman anyway, with her in the role of an ideal mother figure. So there was an actual experience going on, as well as getting him to imagine what life would have been like if that had been an actual experience for him as a child. So it's multi-layered,
and the experiencing self is having a real experience.
Yes, it's a real experience, and it becomes a symbolic experience because she's in a role playing his ideal mother, and she wasn't his real, you know, family connection.
Exactly. No, quite absolutely wonderful.
And you have,
and what I see time and time and time again, and what I hear time and time and time again, is that actually, even in just the space of an hour, people shift stuff that has been with them for decades. And and I had done 15 years of therapy, good quality talking therapy, myself before I came across this method, and then I had to do a lot of it again because I hadn't done it in the body. But now I have done it in the body, and my body is quiet, and my being is 90% of the time very content,
settled.
I'm grounded. In a settled place. And that, I never thought I would reach that, because for all of my 20s and 30s I was a melancholic person. So I lived in a state of grey. And I no longer live in a state of grey. I live in a state of gentle pinkness now.
Lovely.
It's delicious. I mean, it's been completely transformative for me in terms of my life. And I love being able to give that to other people and seeing time and time and time. It's the most effective therapy I've come across.
And also, you say, it was interesting, you say in the book how it's a therapy that you can do where the client gets touched. I mean, physically touched.
Yeah.
In a way that's safe, appropriate, healing, transformative. Maybe we can move into that now by looking at the book, because the book is called Landscapes of the Heart, The Working World of a Sex and Relationship Therapist. And the way you've structured the book, I found was fantastic, because what you do is you go into a case history. So you will describe, really quite briefly, which is good, because I think long ones can get quite difficult to plow through. You paint a picture of a couple and their relationship, and then you do something fantastic. You describe, say some vignettes from a couple of sessions, say the first session and the fourth session or something like that. You then give a kind of director's cut commentary, so that your interventions and so on, and then you give the meta commentary as well, which I found hugely interesting. So you will say something like, I decide that I need to tell her this or say this to her, but I realise I can't go too far and that I need to hold on to that piece till she's a little more able to hear what I'm going to say, further down the track. So you're giving kind of two, but you're also observing yourself and saying, I noticed that I'm holding back on this and I wonder why that is, or something like that. So you're giving your therapist's thoughts about how to proceed, but also your thoughts about what you're doing in the therapy. So, and you did it in a very skillful way. I think that's fantastic. So you do that, and then you go into the theory behind it. So we see the theory in practice first, which is always a great way to learn, I think, and actually see it happening. And then you say, look, this is the theory I was using. And let me give as an example, If I read out a little bit here from where you talk about that, you've got a chapter called the Confusion of Fusion. And here we go. Differentiation is a core concept that I find invaluable as a couples therapist. It is a route map for psychological health. Offering couple therapy that is underpinned by this model transforms a stressed and painful relationship into a calmer and more satisfying one. Another label for differentiation could be personal authority, and I will use these two terms interchangeably. The key distinction is that a differentiated person is able to make a self-directed choice whilst remaining emotionally connected to their partner. This is because they are clear about the difference between what they think and what they feel. There are two opposing drives that all humans have to deal with. The first is the drive for individuality and autonomy, and the second is the drive for bonded intimacy and connectedness. Each person needs to find their relationship to these two competing drives. Finding a healthy balance between these two drives is the journey of a lifetime. So that's a relief. We can't get it right in a minute. The implication of getting stuck at one end of this continuum are profound. However, the couple are in a system together. When one person changes and shifts their balance, it will have a major impact on the other. It only takes one person to differentiate, and that will shift the dynamics of the whole relationship. These behaviours can be changed. And a little further on, you say, the purpose of becoming differentiated, of taking full ownership of oneself, is to reduce our debilitating fears about being abandoned or smothered. Instead, we are aiming for the increasing self-sufficiency and emotional connection that contributes to a healthy relationship. And I think that's a fantastically clear way of talking about these two competing drives we have, or apparently competing drives, of the need for closeness and connection, but the need for differentiation. Mm-hmm. And then the fear that lurks in each of them of either being smothered or being abandoned. And you see that so often in relationships, don't you, where there's this struggle is going on. And if you can just name it, that's huge, I think. Mm. And so that both parties can see it and say, oh, gosh, yes, that's the case. And then the ray of hope you give, as it were, which is where, you know, you don't both have to make the same level of progress. If one of you just makes a shift, then the whole balance is going to change.
Which is a lot of people who come on the courses that I run, teaching therapists about how to work with couples, they may actually only work with individuals.
Yeah.
But once they get the concepts and the idea, you can influence an individual and that will influence the relationship. Yeah. And I'm someone who comes from the fused enmeshed end.
Right.
So I'm someone who wants more and more closeness. Come closer, you know. And of course, I teamed up with someone who's from the wanting more distance. Yes. Well, not differentiated, because differentiated is where you have the balance of the two.
Right.
So actually, he was from the fear of enmeshment, end. So it's been a dance, you know. He's taught me a lot, and I've taught him a lot, and he's learned how to be in an emotional connection, and I've learned that actually my world doesn't fall apart when I'm not intimately bonded in a more way with someone. But actually, I have real intimacy needs two separate people. When you are completely, and I'm putting my hands together and sort of, you know, squeezing tight, when you are completely as one, actually that's not intimacy, because there's no other to be intimate
to be,
with.
To be intimate,
so yeah. What I've realized is that actually you really need a separate other, and I have to respect him and let him be who he is. And there are times when that's really difficult, when he shouts at someone that I think he shouldn't shout at or whatever, and behaves in a way that I disagree with. I used to take that personally and try and control him. And I don't need to do that anymore, because actually he's who he is. And when he does something that I disagree with, that's not a reflection on me. That's a reflection on him. But I used to take it as, you know, I would feel bad and try and squash that behavior because I didn't approve of it. And now I can let him be him. And it works much better. It works much better.
And can we say who he is?
He's
William Ayot.
William Ayot,
who is a poet and a wonderful man. And you've used his poems in the book.
Yeah.
Judiciously, you know. Yes. There aren't masses of poems. There's a couple.
Three, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, three. You know, and it just absolutely works. And you know, for example, you've got a chapter here, Rakesh and Kim, 2 months later, and you've just got a little piece from William which goes, "The anger of a thousand yeses in place of a solitary no. You know, and of course that speaks volumes, and, you know.
And well, that's back to that habit that so many people have, not everyone, but, you know, there's a group of people who are pleasers, who feel like the way they will be accepted in the world is to please other people, and they want to be liked. And so their whole orientation is focused around like me, like me, like me, let me make you happy, then you'll stay with me.
And
in the book I talk about this. I have this model that I created, which was the pleaser and then the boss. So the boss is the one who wants to be in charge and control the other person, and in doing that is stifling the other person and stifling who they are. The pleaser is the one who kind of probably wants to get enmeshed and over caught up with them. And then the other character that you see, that I see often in couple therapy, is the loner. Mm. So is the person who might at first glance look more differentiated because they don't seem to care about what happens in the relationship so much. But actually, they care so much that they can't bear to be in relationships. So they opt out and they take a big distance to keep themselves safe. And that's also an issue with not being, you know, an intimacy issue.
Yeah.
So the fourth, you know, there are these kind of three boxes, the pleaser, the boss and the loner. And then the fourth one is the developer, the self-developer, who is the person who is able to be both in emotional connection and have a sense of who they are and a sense of themselves, able to let the other person be who they are, and is constantly working on the dance and the balance. Because we all swing.
We'll have a bit of the boss, a bit of the pleaser,
exactly,
and a bit of the loner within
exactly.
us. And we'll have a preponderance towards
one.
Yes. And it's all about getting them all in sufficient proportion, as it were. And the majority, would you say, of our sort of energy in the developer?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where we're kind of
that's
headed.
That's the ideal,
you know, if we can do that. Mm. And then noticing when we're not doing that.
Mm.
So my core place is the pleaser.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I'm in a row and I notice myself going into that pleasing place, then I need to take a deep breath.
Disidentify from it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And say, hold on, you know, what do I really want here? I'm doing this to try and make the peace. Is that the most effective thing for me to do right now?
Yeah.
And step aside of that. Because the risk for the pleaser is that they become a martyr.
Yeah.
You know, and I give, and then I get resentful. And that's no good for anyone. That's not good for me, and it's not good for William, you know.
Yeah.
So actually it serves him better when I can say no instead of 1,000 yeses.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And what I love about that, you know, you move from talking about differentiation and fusion to this need we have for sort of bonded intimacy, as you put it, and self-authority, as it were, and independence. It's all around dependency as well, isn't
it's
it?
It's interdependence.
Interdependence.
It's what we're aiming for.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. You then move into this model that you've developed, which is it's hugely rich, and in a sense, I think you've come up with a way of talking about subpersonalities as well. You could see them as subpersonalities, and subpersonalities is an incredibly sort of rich field that John Rowan suggests is a sort of common language we can use to talk about different schools of therapy that don't normally talk to each other and can't sometimes see their connections.
Mm-hmm.
But we can see how the Freudians are talking about the id, the ego and the superego, and the Jungians are talking about archetypes and so on. And actually, you know, if we use subpersonalities as a term, as it were, we can see the connection. So I think that's a hugely helpful model you've come up with. And another particularly helpful idea that I think you talked about was about our the way so many of us feel that the ideal and what we're really looking for in the ideal relationship is one of unconditional love.
Mm.
And you've got a particular take on that, haven't you?
Well, I don't believe in unconditional love in relationships. Which
between
adult partners.
Yeah.
So ideally, a parent should have unconditional love for their child.
Mm.
And whatever the child does, murder, whatever the child does, they should know that they're loved.
Yeah.
But the reality is in adult relationships is that we don't love each other unconditionally. You know, if you hit me, if I'm in a relationship with you and you hit me, then I think I have the right to leave that relationship. If you become an alcoholic, or if I become an alcoholic, you have the right to leave the relationship.
Yeah.
You know, there are certain lines beyond which we don't have to tolerate. And so, you know, sometimes I do get unconditional love in a relationship, and that's just delicious when it comes. So sometimes I'm in my second marriage, and there'll be times when I expect William to be cross with me about something, because my first husband would have been angry with me about that. In my childhood, we didn't really do anger. We did sulking, but we didn't do anger. So I went out and found the angriest man I could and married him. And that was my first husband.
Yeah.
And it took me years to work out that's what I'd done. And again, that's trying to balance something up and learn about something that I was missing. Anyway, so there'll be times when I expect William to be angry with me about something, and actually he's not, and he's loving, and it's just like such a shock.
A lovely wave of love.
Oh, it's delicious. Yeah. So it's not that you don't get unconditional love in a relationship. Sometimes you do, but you can't expect it.
And it's not eternal. I think the sort of idea that we connect with unconditional love is that it's continuous, you know. There might be waves of it or moments of it where you just, you know, but one of the nicest cards that Stephanie ever gave me was a card, which I've got on my shelf in my room, and it's a typewriter, and it typed on the piece of paper and in the picture, it says, every day I love you more and more. And then you open it inside, except yesterday when you really, really annoyed me.
And that's it. That's perfect. Yeah. I mean, that sums it up.
Summed it up, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, you'd have to be a paragon of virtue to be able to give unconditional love. And so one of the things I do is help people to get realistic about that. Having said that, the other, in a therapy session with a couple where that's what they're yearning for, where I would go with that is to take that to the Pest Avoidance System.
Yeah.
And give them ideal parents who would have unconditionally loved them, because that's where it should have come from. And if you get enough of that from your parental archetypes or your real parents, then actually you're fed and you feel full on the inside.
So you don't need to be continually looking
exactly. Yeah. So it's those of us, and sadly it's the majority, but it's those of us who haven't had enough of that that are looking for the healing in the world because our childhoods weren't quite what we needed, or on the day when we really needed it, mum had flu and wasn't able, you know, to give it to us or whatever. And so that's where I feel blessed, because I've discovered this methodology that heals those early patterns that have such a huge impact on our adult relationships. People don't realize how much of what's going on in their adult relationship actually comes from something that happened in their childhood.
But the difference is, what I hear is, of course, you know, the difference is that so much of, you know, coming from Freud, of course, originally, you know, so much emphasis can be placed in therapy on looking back in the past and reliving and talking about it, which, of course, now they're starting to find can be counterproductive. I mean, particularly in you know, PTSD and so on. You know, that you're actually just reinforcing it, because you're reinforcing those neural pathways of memory and so on.
But what we're doing in this is we're making new neural pathways.
Exactly, that's what I mean. You're not ignoring the past. You're engaging with it, accepting it, but then laying down new memories, if you
yeah
like, new
very
experiences.
Very precisely antidoting a particular memory. So for example, I had a guy who came who had been a therapist himself for 15 years, had loads of personal therapy himself, and was talking about the fact that he was felt controlled by his wife. And we started working using the Pest Avoidance method, and what became clear, he suddenly had a flashback to a memory of his mother telling him, shouting at him, don't put the bone handle cutlery in the sink. and he felt controlled by her. And he suddenly realised that actually the root of this issue about not being controlled, you know, feeling controlled, went back to his mother. So we gave him an ideal mother who wouldn't have controlled him and who said, I would have found different ways to communicate with you about the way to wash up bone-handled cutlery. And, you know, he told me, I saw him 3 months later, he said, it's completely transformed. That hot button that I used to have with my partner is no longer there. So it doesn't get pressed in the way that it used to constantly get pressed.
That's fantastic, isn't it? And that's, I think that's one of the reasons why I love therapy so much. I love psychology and I love psychotherapy, is because there can be moments, interventions, techniques, methods, ideas, an exchange. Something can happen, sometimes even that you don't really know what's happened, but you just feel it. You just know, gosh, something's just happened here. And it makes, it seems to make a permanent shift.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, that's why I think people get so excited about, for instance, SFBT, you know, solutions-focused brief therapy, you know, around the miracle question.
Yeah.
Just this one thing.
Yeah.
You know, I've used it a little bit, but I remember using it on with one client. And the shift with that one intervention seems to have been, here, I talked to her the other day, and this is like 3 years down the track or something, seems to have been a permanent major shift in an issue that was bugging her on an almost continuous basis.
Yeah, it seems like the brain can do a paradigm shift and never see the world in quite the same way that it used to again. It feels miraculous when it happens. It's lovely. Hence the miracle question.
Yes, exactly. You know. And that's for me where the world of psychology, the world of psychotherapy, and this other realm of magic, mysticism, who knows, the less labels we place on it, the better, I think. Where they can come together. And the less labels we place on it, the better, in as much as we don't start to overlay our own thoughts and dogma and you know, so on. And this is what I see you doing in your work.
One client said to me, what you do is you help me to work out what my soul most wants but I didn't know I wanted, and then you give it to me using these ideal figures, and it just is so deeply satisfying. It leaves me with pleasure, satisfaction, meaning and connectedness.
Yes, lovely. I think, well, I really recommend Landscapes of the Heart. The working world of a sex and relationships therapist, I suppose in a rather simplistic way, I thought there would be more sex in it. There is some discussion of sexuality, but what was great, I think, is that you brought it in absolutely the right way at the right time as secondary to the issue of relationship and what's really happening in these dynamics, which get reflected in the world of sexual behavior and intimacy and so on. And I think if you're a therapist, if you're working in this field, this book is hugely helpful, I think, because it's a book also that isn't saying, look, you know, really you've got to train in the Pesser-Boyden technique, or you've got to take my courses in order to, you know, but this will whet your appetite. It's not saying that. It's saying, look, whatever you're doing, if you read this will help you in your work with individuals and couples. But also, I think that even if I wasn't working in this field, just somebody who is in relationship. I mean, you know, you've developed a model which you call the model of five-star conscious relating, which is ways of not falling into that habitual pattern of when you get into conflict with your partner. You know, and you give an example of a gay couple where their tendency was when one of them got cross or confronted him, he would literally walk out. He couldn't handle conflict and he would walk out the door. And you suggested that he just stopped and likewise you suggested to the other guy who was doing that. And you've got a thing of, you know, check, compose, clarify, commit, consider and so on. And you've got a procedure that you invite people to try out. grounded in the body, starting with breathing and, mm-hmm. And everything, you know, which I think you know, any couple would find hugely helpful. So, Juliet, thank you so much for this conversation.
It's been my absolute pleasure.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.